From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Race is suddenly white hot again in America. It never goes away, but it's hot now. And screenwriter John Ridley is right in the middle of the cultural conversation. Last year, with an Oscar for his work on 12 Years a Slave. Right now, with his new ABC TV series, American Crime, working in the rich ambiguities of our race relations and assumptions today. This hour on Point, we're talking with screenwriter, director John Ridley. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you watching American Crime? And what do you see in the bigger drama of American race relations right now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Studio City, California, is John Ridley, screenwriter, film director, novelist, raised in a Milwaukee suburb, went off to Indiana and NYU, started in stand-up comedy, wrote for Martin and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, then got serious with novels and film with Three Kings, the Persian Gulf War film, Red Tails, the film story of black pilots in World War II, Undercover Brother, 12 Years a Slave, and this month, the ABC TV series, American Crime. John Ridley, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm sort of taking the liberty of saying that we're in a very hot moment of race in this country. Maybe it's always hot, but it seems hotter to me with Eric Garner and Trayvon and Ferguson and Madison now and University of Oklahoma. And it just seems like it's just exploding around us, John.
I think the awareness is much higher, and I think the opportunity for people to speak out against injustices perceived and also very, very real is what's different. We are not living in 1865. We are not living in 1965 when people were visited daily with either indignities or violence and could do absolutely nothing about it. So I believe at our heart we're a much more safe country, a much more respectful country, and there are more opportunities. Yet when you do see these cycles of violence and a very particular kind of violence that's visited against typically young black men, often unarmed, and or you see people who are caught up in the justice system who are not given the same due process that other individuals are given, or quite frankly, you just see people being dumb about how we interact with each other, the things that we feel like we should still be entitled to say or do. Yes, it seems as though we are living in a very hot time, but I think what we are living in is a time when all of these elements, all these things that are happening, there's a stronger desire to deal with them, to move past them, and to eradicate them. But how do we do it?
You are so tuned in to the nuance and drama of this. I wonder what you're thinking today in the aftermath of that. After all of the struggle that we've seen in Ferguson since the summer, of course, last night, two police officers shot there. As somebody who really looks at the nuance and drama of all this, and as an African-American man, what does that leave you thinking about where we're headed?
It pains me in all regards because should they all be conflated and related, you do get into the cycle then of violence and retribution. And, you look at other places around the world, and it is not just a cycle. I mean, it's a tornado. It's a whirlwind. But in this nation, in a nation that aspires and achieves a certain kind of democracy, when you see these kinds of things happening, there is no reason for it whatsoever. There's no reason for it to happen. There's no reason for retribution. So on the one hand, I certainly – it brings me no joy in any regard when you see it happen to the Trayvon Martins, the Eric Garners, the young man in Madison who was shot, Tony Robinson. But at the same time, when it becomes a situation where other individuals, for whatever reason, want to pay back what happened or there's an anger that boils and in any way, shape or form that they can be related or any people take that relation, that's not working towards improvement in any regard.
I just started watching American Crime, ABC TV series last night. And I have to say, it's terrific. You've got this very complicated scenario in California that starts off looking simple according to our kind of easy stereotyping assumptions about what may have happened, and quickly gets much more nuanced and complicated. And it's a wonderful sort of form for unpacking how our easy assumptions and how much more complicated things are right now. And with all of that, I mean, it's just terrific. But I look at the reality of what's going on, and I wonder, as a screenwriter and director, someone who works in drama, I mean, can you compete with reality? Look at those images out of Ferguson with the rifles on top of the truck, you know, the cops with military-style rifles up there, the super drama of the hands up and guys with a, I don't know, was it an American flag T-shirt throwing the Molotov cocktail? It looks more dramatic than you could possibly make up.
Well, to a degree, the old adage, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. Absolutely, there are elements of life that one cannot chase because they are so extreme and so potent. At the same time, with American Crime, we did not want to chase reality. We did not want to exploit reality. We did not want to take something that was, quote unquote, ripped from the headlines and just mildly repurposed. These are real lives. What's happening to those individuals, whether it's Ferguson or New York or Madison, is real. And the cascade effect is real. But that's what we wanted to get into. You know, you talk much about those images and the iconography that's become related to the circumstances. But then you peel it back and you ask some people, you know, just the names of the individuals involved or about the family members on either side, the families of the victims, the families of the accused, the families of the officers, and what it would be like for those individuals to deal with these circumstances, not in a tight, you know, 42-minute time period where everything is wrapped up neatly, not over weeks, but over months and sometimes over years. You know, if some of these cases, for example, like Trayvon Martin, if they go to trial at all, it takes years. Most cases, when we're dealing with the legal system, never get to trial. And once they do get to trial, however things are resolved, they're really, for one side or the other, there's not a resolution that is commiserate with the crime. And for both sides, really, there is never resolution. On whatever side of the divide you're on, if that's your family member who's either been a victim or has been accused of something, there will never be a resolution that is equal to the pain, the emotional pain and suffering that you're going through. With American Crime, that's what we wanted to get at, not just do extreme television for the sake of being outsized, but really spend time with these families. As you say, the phrase you use, unpacking, to take their emotional baggage and to really remove it piece by piece, moment by moment. And see these individuals dealing with themselves, dealing with their families, how they look at people around them. And by the way, how they look at individuals with their own socioeconomic strata. Race, religion is something that we deal quite heavily with. Christianity, Catholicism.
Islam.
The Muslim faith. Mm-hmm. Things that one doesn't normally see on television in any regard, not broadcast or cable, but this is America as we are. There is probably right now no more reflective show on TV. I don't like to say diverse. Diverse is sort of like a throwback to the 70s, what we were trying to achieve, but reflective. And I can't think of a better moment to be reflective, certainly because of what's going on in America, but also because of where audiences are. What audiences have the capability to understand, absorb, and see in all regards. This is a wonderful time to do any television, but thoughtful television. I'm very fortunate that ABC has given us all the opportunity to delve into the subject matter in a very cinematic way.
You say reflective. Marlo Stern in the Daily Beast says it's probably, American Crime, probably the most provocative show on television. It's called American Crime, but it's anything but a police procedural, though there are police in here, but it's really about the lives around it. For people who have not tuned in yet, John, would you be good enough to just give a summary of what this terrific ensemble cast is up to in the story of American Crime?
Yes, and let me just start very quickly with IDing some of the ensemble cast, an amazing cast, Felicity Huffman, Tim Hutton, Lily Taylor, Regina King, Benito Martinez. It is set in Modesto, which is a smallish town in Central Valley in California. And it's about a husband and wife, Matt and Gwen Skokie. And he is a war veteran from the Iraq War. She was a runner-up in the Miss Modesto beauty pageant. They are found. He is shot and killed. She is shot and alive but gravely wounded and appears to have been sexually assaulted in their home. The initial suspects are predominantly black and Hispanic. And there is a very quick move to justice. as well as a rush towards justice.
Or and, judgment anyway.
Yes.
It, certainly towards judgment mm-hmm. And the assumption that once these individuals are arrested, it's a very cut and dry case, both in regards to who potentially committed the crime and why the crime is committed. In that very first episode, we meet the parents of the victims. We meet the family members of the accused. And it becomes very, very clear that the case in all regards, not just in the legal aspects but also in the emotional aspects, is far more complicated than one would imagine, as well as these individuals are far, far more complicated, how they perceive each other, how they perceive people on the opposite sides of the case that are shaping up. And again, this show is so much about the cascade effect after the arrest. In television, things happen very – historically, in episodic television, things happen very, very quickly. With American Crime, we have 11 episodes and we take our time. We are not a language show. We are not without events happening in every episode. We are not without certain emotional resolutions in every episode. Mm-hmm. But we spend time with these individuals and see what it's like to be in a system and what it's like to have their faith tested, religious faith, secular faith, familial faith, all of those regards, what it's like to be tested over time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with screenwriter, director, novelist John Ridley, maybe the hottest screenwriter in the country right now, won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, created ABC's new American Crime. He is hot on race relations just when race is huge again in this country. The context, hot as it can be. Here's Ferguson in August. And here from the pilot episode of American Crime aired just last week, a police officer informs Russ, played by Timothy Hutton, that they're working to find his son's killer.
We have a very strong description of a vehicle of interest that was in the vicinity during the shooting. The driver we're looking for is a young Hispanic male.
And his wife, Barb, played by Felicity Huffman, is told here about the investigation. And there are quick assumptions.
What are the police doing?
Well, they have a description of a car.
When was Matt killed? Sunday? It's Tuesday. That all they have is a description of a car?
And they said that they think it might be an Hispanic kid.
Some illegal?
Just Hispanic.
Things get complicated in a hurry. The Daily Beast calls it probably the most provocative show on television. John Ridley joins us from Studio City in California. And John, lots of callers for you. Davion is calling from Nashville. You're on with John Ridley.
Hey, hello, Tom. Hey, thank you for having Mr. Ridley, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Ridley, I have followed your work for a long time, going back to U-Turn. Really enjoy what you've put out. When you talk about American crime and the fact that, like Tom just said, it gets complicated so quickly. Another complicated show, if you remember, I'm sure you're familiar with The Wire, was very complicated. Was well, you know, well received by the critics, but wasn't very popular, even though it was an HBO show. And when I go back to 2002. And your undercover brother. It was very simplistic, very funny, but very, very poignant. I mean, the characters, no, there weren't any names. They were just called, you know, smart brother, white she-devil, undercover brother. Just very simple that everybody could relate to. And we could see right there some of the superficiality of the racism that we all live under, black and white. And I'm just wondering if you have any plans to do something similar to that again. And one last thing, I know you're sometimes a contributor to Morning Joe. On the topic of race, what's your take on the situation as it was covered by them yesterday morning, if you know what I'm talking about?
What are you talking about, Davian? Which one in particular yesterday, Morning Joe? Talking about Oklahoma?
Yeah, the thing was where they were trying to, I guess, equate the scenes in Oklahoma with hip-hop or, I guess, rap music and whatnot. And I know Mr. Ridley has sometimes been a contributor on Morning Joe, so I wonder what his take on that was.
But let me tackle the last part first. And I did not see Morning Joe yesterday, and so I don't know what the specifics of the conversation are. And I agree with Joe sometimes, disagree with them, but I don't want to get on them or what they may have said without having heard it. So I heard it. I'm not trying to dodge it, but I just don't know. With regard to Undercover Brother, thank you very much for appreciating it in any regard. I you know, it was a very much a fun film to work on. It started out as an internet series and one of the few that made the transition to film. And it was – I mean, look, it was a satire. It was funny. It was reductive in a certain sense. And even in that sense of, you know, just having simple names, you know, Smart Brother, White She-Devil, you know, that more satirizing the fact that we sometimes, you know, we put labels on ourselves or other people and they're very simplistic and that's meant to, you know, explain individuals and it doesn't do necessarily a very good job of that. With The Wire, I mean, look, The Wire was one of the all-time great shows in the history of television and its greatness is not determined by the number of people who ever had the opportunity to view it. It was simply a phenomenal show in any regard. I would personally be very hesitant to put American Crime and The Wire in the same sentence. It's going to take us a long time before I think we're even in that same paragraph. I would say in terms of popularity, you know, just the fact that we're on broadcast television, we have the opportunity to reach a much larger audience. You know, in our premiere week, both with include the DVRs and our rebroadcast, you know, we had almost 15, 16 million households that viewed this show, which is just a phenomenal number and one of the best mid-season airings, you know, this year other than Empire, which is obviously killing it. So I'm not worried at this point about cultural density. We have the cultural density, the fact that we are on the broadcast platform, the fact that we're here talking about the show, the fact that we have 15 million people who've chosen to view it, and the fact that we have, you know, 10 more weeks for individuals to find the show and for it to keep growing. People have – audiences have matured so much just even in the time since The Wire. And that was an immensely complicated show, dealt with complicated issues with complicated characters. And at that time, it was a show that could only live on HBO. But because of shows like that, because of shows like The Sopranos, because of so much television that is out there right now, even when on broadcast, when you see what Shonda's doing with her shows on Thursday nights,
Shonda Rhimes,
Blackish, Fresh Off the Boat, Shonda Rhimes, yeah, with her shows, audiences have just matured and they want content. So it's a great time to be doing television in any regard, but one that when you have programming that treats adult audiences as adults and believes that you can cultivate audiences over time, then you have an opportunity to do shows like American Crime and see out of the gate, again, 15 million people arriving to the show just in our launch week.
I want to talk about this creative cultural moment in many ways, but particularly in regard to race. It's hot right now. Look back. I mean, you wrote a bit for The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Of course, you starred a young Will Smith back in the day. John Ridley wrote for it. Here's a scene with Jeffrey the Butler, played by Joseph Marcel.
Master Carlton, I have to take this tray up to your mother. So on your way out, would you mind taking out the garbage?
That was then. This is now. Hector Tons, played by Richard Cabral, is shot by police in American Crime. They connect him to the murder of Matt Skokie in the hospital. In American Crime, he talks with a police officer about what he knows.
There's this black dude. Him and this girl, a couple of meth heads. It's a regular custody. He's always looking to buy. He comes to me Sunday. I get him, so he starts rolling. He wants more, but he's broken. I tell this fool, I can't do nothing for him. And he starts getting puffed up. Hyped up, talking about how he's old, how he needs to settle up a score. Says it's this white guy that owes him. He tells me he can get me paid after.
After what?
After. That'll matter to me.
You put Fresh Prince up against American Crime, John Ridley, and it's just so striking. What's how much of this is a change in you? How much is this is a change in the audience, the culture? What you say we're ready for a lot, matured a lot. Where are we in that readiness now?
Well, let's talk about my arc just for a moment first. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and by the way, when I got that job, you know, this is a hit show on NBC, a young Will Smith, who everybody could tell was on his way to stardom, you know, that was absolutely wonderful. And it was wonderful just as a job. It was wonderful as an opportunity to learn how to write in terms of an immediate process. You know, their television happens very, very quickly. So it's not theoretical. You've got to get things done. You have to learn to work with directors. You have to learn to work with hair, makeup, wardrobe, all those very fundamental things. There's very few places that are better in terms of acquiring an education of the process than television. But within those years, you know, much changed for me. I started writing novels. As you mentioned, I also started doing reporting for magazines, writing longer pieces, doing pieces for NPR, National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. You just – once you spend time in the world and you meet people with all different kinds of ideas and from all different backgrounds, that kind of story writing is very attractive to you. You know, as you get older, as you become a parent, as you, you know, start paying more taxes, as you acquire a home, you know, all of those things start messing with your perceptions, or certainly changing the perception that you have of the world around you, of the stories that you want to try to tell, and just the concept of telling stories that are a little bit more real and involve individuals who are a little bit more authentic. The actor that you talked about in that scene from American Crime, Richard Cabral.
Terrific.
We found him out of Homeboy Industries, and if people don't know what Homeboy Industries is, it is an organization dedicated to taking men and women who have been involved in gangs mm-hmm. their whole lives. And their whole lives, we're talking people in their 20s. And some have been incarcerated, some have just been in the gang culture, and rehabilitating them and helping them accomplish positive things in life. And Richard wanted to be an actor. He is a phenomenal individual. He is a talented individual. He's a person who has so much heart and humanity. And to have an individual like that portray a character like Hector, who I wanted so much to be complicated and not just one thing and upend expectations, to have a person like Richard, who is all of those things, portray a character like Hector and can make sure that he is a character and not a caricature. As a storyteller, as a writer, as a director, that's what – as I matured, that's what I wanted. And I think an audience can tell the difference between as wonderful as Fresh Prince was, as Martin was, mm-hmm. as shows that I worked on, they were pure entertainment. There's nothing wrong with pure entertainment. It goes back to Sullivan's Travels. You know, sometimes sure. a laugh, even if it's just a laugh, it has importance in our lives. But sometimes, and as I said earlier, now you have audiences that want to be challenged, that want House of Cards, that want Game of Thrones, that want something bigger, sometimes not just visually bigger, but bigger in terms of its scope and scale, in terms of its sociopolitical thought. That's sort of where I've arrived to, and certainly in the last few years of my life with Red Tails, with All Is By My Side, the film about Jimi Hendrix, mm-hmm. and a very unique year in his life, certainly 12 Years a Slave, and now with American Crime. I wanted to do shows that lived – again, of course, it's entertainment, but in a more real space, if not a wholly real space, a more real space. And again, in our launch week, clearly there's an audience, you know, 15 million strong that responded to that.
And it is not just black and white in the American crime world. The racial and ethnic coloration, very diverse. David in New Orleans, you're on the air with John Ridley. David, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Gentlemen, nice to meet you, and thank you for having me. Mr. Ridley, I love your work, but the question I want to ask you, you say that audiences are maturing, that we're ready for these stories, and I would like to ask you, do you think it's because of all of this open racism coming into the media, the Sigma Alpha Epsilon chant, Trayvon Martin, the incident in New York City? Do you think that because now this is in front of our faces, undeniably happening in front of us, and we're realizing that the politically correct world, quote-unquote, that we live in is actually a lie? Do you think that people need these kinds of stories to just deal with it and have some sort of understanding of what's going on and how to move past that?
John Ridley.
I believe that we as a nation are maturing in general. These things that we're seeing all around us are very painful. But as I alluded to earlier, there were times when there were, you know, and not that long ago, but when there were open lynchings, when people were being killed, when cross burnings were the norm, and it was tolerated and it was accepted. And, you know, it was painful for people who lived in it. And by the way, not just black people, you know, there were white people who were against it, but there was not much to be done. And by the way, it wasn't just sort of that open racism too. You know, it was not just things that were going on in the South. You could go to places in you know, Cicero outside of Chicago, where all things were fine as long as you didn't try to move into this neighborhood or you know, send your kids to this school when they had busing in Boston. You know, these things tend to be problematic when they're right in front of us. We trip on what's right in front of us. So it's not just limited to one geographical space. It's not just limited, by the way, to one race. As you see now in California, you have black and Hispanic school systems where kids are in open conflict. We are, I think, in a space where we are ready to ask questions. And certainly as a television show, it's not for me to answer questions. I'm not an expert in any of these fields. But audiences are ready to join the conversation. They're ready to ask questions. There are people who are fed up with what is happening. Sometimes they're fed up with different perspectives on what's happening. But again, we're at a place where we're ready to ask questions. And that, to me, is the maturation process.
We're talking,
where life as usual, business as usual is not good enough. People are ready to examine. People are ready to ask questions. But then when we really become mature, it's when we can all step away and start to answer those questions. It's not my goal, as I said, to try to answer questions for anyone. By the way, it's not my goal to arrive to your home every evening and try to preach or proselytize. Entertainment at its best is an apparatus for delivering emotions. And with a show like this, with something like 12 Years a Slave, you know, people used to – I would hear them say about 12 Years a Slave, I know all there is to know about slavery, which is already an ignorant remark when people talk in absolutes. But it wasn't about delivering a sermon or an education on slavery. It was about delivering emotion and putting people in a space where they felt something for people that they did not know, maybe didn't agree with. But at the same time, when you looked at slavery, that was a mass psychosis that was going on. I believe that right now we are still working through some of that psychosis and some of those leftover emotions. What happened to us as a nation didn't happen over a few years. It happened over hundreds of years. Moving out of it is going to take time. We are moving out of it, but we are kidding ourselves when we don't think there are lingering effects. We see that in all kinds of ways, and it's up to all of us, and I do mean all of us, myself included, people of all races and all backgrounds, to commit ourselves to moving past some of these things.
Pat in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, John's hometown. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I would like to just make a quick comment, and I'll take the response off the air. I was really looking forward to this series with a lot of enthusiasm, and I started watching the first show, and I couldn't even make it through. It was so upsetting, and I'm just wondering if there's other people out there who are having the same problem I am.
Pat, I appreciate your call. John Ridley, this is not easy listening, easy watching. This is challenging watching. I found it very gratifying, but I can understand if somebody just felt, oh, this is so uncomfortable, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, Pat, I truly, very sincerely don't take offense that for whatever reason, and by the way, Pat didn't identify, but for whatever reason that the show was not something that Pat wanted to engage in. I mean, look, I've done very light programming and people didn't watch, done heavier things and people didn't engage. So I get that. That's the reason why there's so many channels out there and there's
yep.
so much television. And by the way, read a book or what have you. So very sincerely, Pat, I don't take offense. And certainly anybody from Milwaukee.
but she's not alone. The Huffington Post says the beautiful discomfort of John Ridley's American Crime. The Root says American Crime creator John Ridley brings the pain.
Absolutely. And in this regard, I don't know any other way to present this program without being emotionally honest to things that are happening in America right now. This is not a true story. This is fictionalized narrative. But when you look at the anguish that folks are going through all over the country in all regards on any side of the divide, if we're going to present something to the public that even in any regard mirrors that, then we've got to have that same kind of emotional impact. And we absolutely will not shy away from it in any regard.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with screenwriter, director, novelist John Ridley. Maybe the hottest screenwriter in the country right now. Won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, created ABC's new American Crime. He is hot on race relations, and race relations are a huge subject right now. Here's a little bit from 2013 film 12 Years a Slave. Solomon Northrup, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, tells fellow slave Eliza, played by Adepero Oduye, that he will not wallow in sorrow because he is a slave.
I will not fall into despair I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
Oh, Ford is your opportunity? You think he does not know that you are more than you suggest, but he does nothing for you, nothing. You are no better than prized livestock. Call for him. Call, tell him of your previous circumstances and see what it earns you, Solomon.
And here from American Crime, the mother of the murdered Iraq war veteran takes the news that her son is dead.
It just figures my son goes off to another country to fight. Then he comes home to America and he gets killed by somebody from another country.
Well, things are complicated there. Felicity Huffman playing Barb in American Crime. Megan in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you're on the air with John Ridley.
Hi, I just wanted to say I really love 12 Years a Slave and I am loving this show. And the part about being uncomfortable watching the show, it's not uncomfortable. It makes you think outside the box and really puts you into the space where the characters are. And I just wanted to say thanks.
Well, listen, thank you for your comment. And I do, absolutely, as I said earlier to Pat, I appreciate that some people may be uncomfortable. It may not be for everyone. But for those who choose to view the show, for those who have the capacity to remain with the show, I also think that you'll see a lot of beauty. You know, in 12 Years a Slave, very, very difficult. But to see the moments of people appreciating life, appreciating the world around them, learning to respect one another. It's very, very powerful. And that's the way life is sometimes. We are surrounded by very, very difficult things. But those individuals who try to make a better world around them, whether it's in small ways with their family, whether it's with larger ways, the community around them, it's always quite powerful. So I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate comments on both sides. People who find it so strong because, to a degree, that was the intent, to not do television that was just an after-dinner mint that just went away after a little bit of a tasting. But I also very much appreciate individuals who choose to watch, to choose to view, who choose to think, and choose to move away from this content or any other content and look at the world around them in a different way. That is the purpose of art.
John Ridley, I want to ask you about your own politics here a little bit. And for listeners, we've got a little bit of difficult language that we're coming to here on the race front. So if that's a problem for you, beware. John, you wrote an essay back in 2006. This was at a time you were looking back to when Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell had really stood up in the aftermath of 9/11. Maybe that really got you inspired. You wrote an essay. It was published in Esquire magazine with a tough headline. And we're going to use the N-word here for just a second, but advisedly, and just going to what you wrote, it was called The Manifesto of Ascendancy for the Modern American Nigger. And in this essay, you drew a bright line between, I think, what you were calling African-Americans who had stepped up and taken advantage of the opportunity brought by the civil rights movement and those who had not. And you said, we need to send them on their way. We need to start extolling the most virtuous ourselves. It's time to celebrate the new black Americans, those who have sealed the deal, that is, the what was opened up by the civil rights movement, and those who hadn't. You got a lot of pushback on this. Jelani Cobb, who's been our guest here, was really offended at the whole piece. What about your politics and the line that you were drawing there between sort of good people and bad people within your own race, if I may put it that way?
Well, good people and bad people in all regards. And at that time, particularly in the pre-Obama era, and one of the things that was, you know, very interesting about that article is sort of predating and predicting the concept of us taking a stronger stance within politics itself, not merely standing outside the political system and pushing for change, but really investing in the political system. And I think most people were completely unaware of the Heinen spy plane crisis. And at that time, for about a couple of weeks, Colin Powell and Condi Rice were the face of foreign policy around the world. Two people of color, not elected officials, but had essentially foreign policy in their hands, and where at that time Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld wanted to take a very, very hard line against what was going on, these two individuals understood the capacity for negotiation and how important that was. and really questioning the idea of, can we then take the next step, not just be merely appointed officials and not merely just hector at the political system from one side or the other, but really invest in it, franchise ourselves through the electoral process and have ownership. Now, I had honestly, I'd hoped for better that when a – and I had no idea that it would happen so quickly that we'd have a self-identifying black man as president in the United States. But I believe that when it happened, the response would be well, I certainly thought it would be less racial.
You were tough then, though. You said there were you wrote there were too many kids aggrandizing the thug life and way too many African Americans doing far too little with the opportunities others earned for them. And I found myself thinking, wow, this is interesting. Here's John Ridley bringing so much racial nuance to life. Maybe this is a Republican John Ridley. It's a free country.
You know what? I have to be honest with you. I think it's far too simple. You know, here's where I have a problem is once people start espousing thought that we then ultimately – we have basically two camps. We have a two-party system in this country. And once individuals start espousing thoughts or extolling ideas, you know, it becomes, well, you're a Democrat or you're a Republican. The concept that we as people of color oftentimes have to stop waiting for a hug from outside of ourselves that is never going to come, I think is very, very important. When we look at when we're sort of aghast at a system that still is not welcoming, we should not be surprised. I don't think – and unfortunately, I think I was in somewhat surprised that once we franchise, you know, once we allow ourselves to be elected, that there's still going to be individuals who have a problem with that, who cannot see the legitimacy in that election. And that was very, very painful. But I have to say at the same time, you know, we have got to do a better job of either making sure that we are taking care of ourselves because we have that capacity now, or ultimately also understand that there are – in any group, there are individuals who are never going to take full opportunity with the opportunities that are presented. And when I was growing up, you know, even, you know, you played clips from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you know, the conceit of that show was, you know, who's down and who's real. And to be a person of color who's educated or intellectual or speaks a certain way or grew up in a neighborhood, you weren't really black. You know, that doesn't constitute blackness. And just saying at that time that there are people of color, and we still sort of have that problem, and some of it is politics and some of it is perception, that individuals like Colin Powell and Condi Rice, well, they're not really black. They're sellouts. They're not really doing things. But that concept that we've got to get past that, that there is not any one kind of blackness, and that is just as – it's as acceptable, it is as correct, and it's as true. And rather than particularly in that time period, you know, there's only one kind of black. It's, you know, it's real. It's, you know, it's urban. It's this or that. But to really look at all of ourselves and say, why are we not holding up all aspects of blackness and why are we not encouraging that? Because we've got to get over.
Are you more sympathetic to the street culture today, having seen all the events of the last decade to the – or are you still drawing that line between, you know, those sort of stepping
up? I don't know that there is, you know, there are individual – to the concept, even as you put that question, that street culture equates failure or middle classdom equates success, you know, I have a problem with just, again, that very simple binary stand.
I guess that's how I read you in your 2006 essay.
Yeah, but that's not the concept that people can come from one place and achieve. I mean, look, you have people during the civil rights era who are certainly coming from truly, literally ghettoized areas and accomplishing. You have people like President Obama who grew up in difficult circumstances, who ended up being a community organizer, which was much maligned. But chose to do things with himself and then accomplished in the sense, again, of being franchised. So the concept that people have to come from one area or another is the only measure of success or failure. My issue is when we look at one area or the other and then purely ascribe, well, you've got to have the trappings of being urban or being an urban area, and that equates real blackness. And or if you are from a suburban area or if you have a particular background, you're not authentically black. To hold up one over the other or to dismiss one simply because of the metrics, that's where the problem arises.
Can we go to Oklahoma, the University of Oklahoma, and the Sigma Alpha Epsilon chant caught on videotape and now all over the world this week? Very straight up racial old time terms, talking about lynching and using the N-word in anything but advised way. Were you shocked by that? That, you know, just behind the glass of the bus was still going on?
No. I mean, it's my, you know, look, I will say this, you know, the N word, different from the R word being the name of a football team where people are monetizing, you know, basically a slur.
Native Americans, you know, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I have a problem with that. You know, the N word, and I never want my kids to be afraid of a word. You know, I never want my kids to be afraid of anybody. And I think that when, you know, just the fact that in a intellectual setting, you and I having a conversation, we're mindful of the word. I'm not going to use it right now mm-hmm. with your audience. But mm-hmm. the fact that we can't have a discourse about it, you know, what you're basically saying to those kids on that bus, go ahead and use that word because that's a painful word and you can say those kinds of things. I'm not surprised that people do that in the privacy of their own homes. I'm not surprised that those feelings still exist. My thing is, you know, you look for the vast majority of people, when you put an incident like that in context, you know, they got a real big problem with it, as they should. We're living, though, in an age where euphemisms run wild and people can do things like, you know, SB 1070 or stop and frisk or, you know, ask the president for his birth certificate. And those things are all, you know, it's fine. You know, it's just that's no problem. You know, we got to change textbooks. You know, we talk about two things in textbooks that are too painful. You know, it's not the obvious. You know, everybody, you know, these kids' parents are out on television, you know, just weeping and sobbing and wailing for their kids. You know, the mistake that was made was so clear, so obvious, so repugnant. That's not problematic. The pushback is immediate. The problem is in these other areas in life where it's happening, and it's happening in broad daylight, but the words have changed, the style has changed, the ideology around it has changed. You know, we can't possibly have young kids reading about American history because it, you know, we don't want to, you know, slavery is a negative. Why are they learning about that? Why are they learning about
ignore it, 9066? Push it away. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, just, you know, it, to me, those kinds of things, that's essentially, you've got an embassy that's about to be overrun and they're taking all the files and they're throwing them in the incinerator. That, to me, is far more insidious than people. You see what happened on the college campus where you have kids, black and white, you know, standing together, going, saying, this is wrong. We're yep. expelling these kids. We're shutting down this fraternity house. Everybody responded as they should. You have textbooks being changed. Nobody cares. You have laws in Arizona where, you know, people seem to be illegals can be pulled over and pulled out of their car. What is that determining factor? We know what that determining factor is. Those things are far more painful to me. I feel badly about these kids, but this is something they got to carry with them for the rest of their life. This is not the old days where you could, you know, whip around a Confederate flag and scream in people's faces and then go about your daily life. Mm-hmm. So things have changed, but where the difficulty lays, where we have not changed, it's right in front of us, and it is in broad daylight.
Carrie in Port Washington, Wisconsin. Carrie, you're on the air with John.
Hello. I just wanted to comment that I've seen the diversity between different demographic locations. For example, I grew up in Mequon. I went to Homestead with John. And so proud of you, by the way. And
thank you.
Outside Milwaukee. That's great.
Right. And I moved to Port Washington, where it's quite different. And work in the inner city. I work on 3rd and Clark, and I work with all these young people that are so affected by the attitudes in this country that realistically have not changed all that much in my eyes. They're slightly different. They come across differently, but they have the same background. And I have a 13-year-old, and we watch American Crimes, and I'm telling you, it's such a learning tool for him because we're Jewish. We were... I had my own persecution when I was in middle school and high school and dealt with it and moved on. But for him to see that my significant other, who is African American, and how all these different things come in play, and he knows where I work, he knows my clientele, he's met them, he's worked there in summers, and it's important to educate that population of kids in this country so that they can grow up and be and emulate what John is talking about and what he's trying to show, and maybe some more changes can be made because I want to crawl in a hole. I'm ashamed of some of the things that are going on, and I myself as one person don't feel like I have a whole lot to do with making a mark on changing it.
Carrie, our time is short. I appreciate your call. John Ridley, in the midst of everything we're seeing in the headlines right now, are you hopeful that we are still in motion, that long arc toward justice that Martin Luther King Jr. and President Obama talk about is still working?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't be anything but hopeful. I have a family. I have kids. You know, Carrie, you talk about you can't change the world. But you're dealing with your children, and you are educating them. You are teaching them. You're trying to broaden their horizons. That's where I think we can affect change. Yeah, there are a lot of people out there trying to work in the world, and I admire them. I wish I could do more, and I probably can choose to do more. But we can't affect the world around us, and what you're doing, and that means the world. So I'm positive, and we all have to remain positive because we are making an impact little by little, moment by moment, day by day, and I encourage us all to continue in that regard.
John Ridley, with 12 Years a Slave and American Crime, I would say I think you're doing your bit. Thank you very much for being with us today, John.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, John Ridley, screenwriter, director with ABC TV's American Crime, last year with an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, Best Adapted Screenplay there. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point.